Welcome to the Bonner Breakdown. The Bonner Breakdown is here to have conversations, create connection, and find things to celebrate. So get ready for the good report. Today we have Executive Director of the Friends of Scotchman Peaks Wilderness, Phil Huff, with us today. We'll hear great stories about his adventures and what he is doing with the Friends of Scotchman Peaks Wilderness. Please follow us on social media and enjoy the episode. Hey everyone, welcome to the Bonner Breakdown. I'm here with Phil Huff from the Friends of Scotchman Peaks Wilderness. Phil, welcome to the program. It's good to have you on.
Thank you, Chris. It's great to be here.
Yeah, awesome. Awesome. So I'm excited to dig in and find out a little bit more about the Friends of Scotchman Peaks and hear some of your stories, because you've got a pretty awesome background with hiking. Yeah. And you've done a lot of it. So would love to hear about our current region and some of your stories. But before that, we got to dive into the good report. We always want something notable and good news at the beginning of each show. And there's a lot of craziness happening right now, so a little bit of good news always helps. So do you have anything for the good report?
Yeah. Well, we had a great weekend. The first Saturday in June is always National Trails Day. And okay, this year, things were kind of on hold because of the pandemic. And then, rain set in last week pretty good too. But yeah, Idaho Trails Association got cleared by the Forest Service to start their trail project season. And I went out as a volunteer. And the case of full disclosure, I'm also on the advisory board and a founding board member. So really vested interest in seeing the organization succeed. And Tom Dabrowski, the local, the president who lives locally, managed to get 12 people together on 4 days' notice to go out and clear a trail on a rainy day.
Yeah.
If that's not good, I'm not sure what is.
Come on. Well, I think some people have been pent up and ready to get out and do some work, you know, so that's great. That's awesome. So now you did Mikinik. Tell us a little bit about that trail. How long is it?
It's about 3.5 miles. Okay. It rises about 2,800 feet, I think. So it's a steep trail. And steep trails, when there's lots of rain, can be easily eroded. So mostly what we were doing was digging out water bars so that they function better, installing some new ones, doing a little bit of brush work, and a couple people went up top to take care of some downed trees that were creating workarounds. Okay. There were also some huge trees came down, already cleared out by the Forest Service, that left big holes where the root wads came up to the trails. And so we filled in probably half a dozen of those.
Okay, cool. Well, and now it's all cleared all the way up and everybody's free to go.
Everyone's free to go. It's awesome. It's safe again.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. Well, we've gone up there a few times, but I've never gone all the way to the top. And usually that's toddler driven, the time or young kids. So sometimes it's a little more than what they could do, but the view's gorgeous.
It's a great trail for that. You can go a couple miles up and you get that second set of benches. That's a nice turnaround. A lot of people just do that.
Yep. And it's gorgeous. You just love the view from all of the nice trails around here. Have great views no matter where you go. You can't miss out. Well, my good report is that that we're still on progress with reopening Idaho, and that we haven't seen a giant second wave come through. So I think that's just really good news that we're able to continue to get this economy moving again. And it was really good just to see that the predicted job losses stopped in May, that kind of turned around. So I think for everybody's benefit, that's always good news when, you see those jobs numbers turn around. You're like, oh, okay, good. Cause we're in the recession officially, they declared the recession, but it's good to see that it wasn't still sliding negative.
Yeah. Every passing day, it's more hopeful.
It is. Yeah. It's very, very good. So, well, awesome. And, for the good report, I just say thank you so much for bringing that today, and we're gonna dive in now to a little bit more about you. So give us a little bit of your history, Like, when did you come to Idaho? What's kind of your story?
My wife and I moved here in 2002. Mm-hmm. So we're just about 18 years on now.
Okay.
We had at the time decided we were tired of living in and near cities. She was telecommuting anyway.
Okay.
So as long as we found a good place with some solid internet, she could work from anywhere.
And okay.
Yeah. I had been in the hotel business, which I was getting tired of. It's stressful.
It is. Yep.
And very willing to reinvent myself. That's the most American of stories, right? Right? The second act. So we looked very decidedly for a place that had four seasons of recreation. We wanted to be able to do cross-country skiing and snowshoeing in the winter, paddling and hiking in the summer. We both enjoy spring and fall. We had my sister had been coming up to Sandpoint for years and borrowing a cabin. So we visited and we thought, oh, this is just ideal. And to boot it, it had a little bit of arts and culture.
A little bit.
Great food and a lake and a mountain. So
awesome.
We picked up and moved in 2002.
Okay, great. And then were you working? Were you retired? What was kind of your...
So I left the hotel business. And what we really like to do, and I'm sure we'll delve into this, is to hike. And so since the early 90s, I've really defined who I am, not by the career I've had, but by the hikes I've taken. The day we moved, we had 3 days before we left for a 2.5 month hike. And then we got back, we left 2 months later for a 3 month paddle trip.
Okay. Now you just said some things. I just got to slow down because people might've missed the fact that you did a 2.5 month hike.
Yeah, it was a relatively short one.
Relatively short one.
We'll segue into that.
Yeah.
We consider ourselves long-distance hikers, through hikers to our friends. And so my wife and I together have hiked the triple crown of long-distance trails in America, the Appalachian Trail, the Continental Divide Trail, and the Pacific Crest Trail.
Amazing.
And we're still together.
That's the miracle in and of itself, right? So, you guys are long distance hikers. What is it about long distance hiking that really, you know, captivated your attention and made you go, yeah, that's something I really want to do?
Yeah, I was first drawn to it when I was in my teens. Mm. And I think this story holds true for a lot of people who started to do long distance hiking about the same time I did. They saw one of the National Geographic special issues on one of the long trails, or they saw one of the television shows that profiled one of these trails.
Right.
And for me, I was drawn to the general concept, but really drawn to the idea of the Pacific Crest Trail in particular.
There's something there's something definitely alluring about the views, about the distance, about the challenge of it.
It's the challenge, the physical challenge. It's the mental challenge. It's the idea that you can take, for me, the first hike, 6 months, and live in a very determined manner. Every day you're doing one of three things. You're either walking or eating or sleeping, and you're repeating, and every day you're doing that. And so it's a really good way to spend some time with yourself, get to know yourself in ways that you can't otherwise. And and that was something going in that was on the fringe of the reasons, but really as I went through it, and I think this is the experience many people have, it's one of the benefits they see. And so most long-distance hikers I've met who are successful on their first trail, either it becomes a lifelong passion, which it did for me, or they're one and done. There's not much in between. And for those who it becomes a lifelong passion, you rearrange your world so that it's not a question of what am I going to go back to do for a career. It's what job am I going to take that's going to enable my next hike.
Wow. Yeah, that's amazing. That's really cool. So... Give us an overview. What are the biggest differences between the three trails?
Great question. So the first one I did, the Pacific Crest Trail, combines the physical elements of some really challenging terrain. You go through deserts that are extremely dry, 25, 30-mile sections with no water. You're hiking through early season snowpack in the Sierras where navigation is a problem, high river runoffs, all kinds of physical challenges that also create mental stress. And it's long, 2,700 miles, but the grade is pretty even. It was built to accommodate stock animals, so constant 7% grade compared to the Micnic, which, say, might be 14 or 15%.
Right, yeah.
The Appalachian Trail, shorter, more heavily populated on the East Coast, fewer switchbacks, no grade rules there. If you were to actually straighten out some of those switchbacks that existed on the PCT or thin them out, rather, they'd be about the same length. It takes about the same amount of time to go 600 miles less. So physically, very demanding trail.
Wow.
The Continental Divide Trail takes this drama of these uncertain unknowns and mental stresses and physical stress and crunches them together.
Is that the most difficult of the three? I
think for most people, they find it the most difficult.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. That's interesting. So now you build your life around this concept of being able to hike and to do 2.5 months to go on a short hike.
Yeah.
So building your life up here, you're able to do that. What else was your
So your when we moved up here, process? I wasn't really sure what I'd do for work, but we did have our next couple trips planned out.
Mm-hmm.
So we moved in 2002 and we had a trip planned that year, and again, one in 2003 and 2004.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, figuring for 2 years, I would go through the cycle of planning, preparing, getting us ready, doing the hikes while Deb worked. And then I'd find something to do. Wasn't really quite sure what it was. But during that interim period, I became engaged in the community, joined the Native Plant Society, the Conservation Committee, got involved with the forest planning process that I just started in 2003, started attending public meetings for that. I became very interested in the conversation, particularly around wilderness areas.
Okay.
It was one that a number of people in the room felt needed more attention, that it just wasn't being discussed or vetted at the level of some of the other topics in the revision.
Sure. Yeah.
And wilderness was an area that I had some experience in, literally having walked through on the three hikes, over 100 wilderness areas total. And also we paddled the Yukon River, seeing a whole bunch of wildernesses there. So as I became engaged with the wilderness question and the forest planning, meeting other people who also had similar interests, we thought that we would form, and did, the Friends of Scotchman Peaks to address the particular question of wilderness in the Scotchmans and the larger question of how it fit into the forest plan. Mm-hmm. So that was 2005.
Okay.
Volunteer position, not paid, but one which my wife gladly supported me in doing. And then a year or so later, I started piecing together, like many people in North Idaho, a lot of part-time jobs.
Right. Yeah. Absolutely.
Helping out several organizations, doing a little bit of outreach with this or that, some technical editing, leading some youth trips for one of the schools for troubled teens in Montana. Okay. And there was the summer of 2007 where I had four different jobs paying me part-time and a couple different things like the Scotchman Peaks I was volunteering for. And it was like, oh my God, we need another hike plan so I can move away from some of this. So we planned three summers, 2008, 9, and 10, to hike the Continental Divide Trail in three chunks, 1,000-mile hikes. My long-distance friends will call them short hikes or section hikes. But most people, you say, I'm going to take off for 2 months and hike 1,000 miles. They'll call it a good adventure.
Yeah, it might be a hike.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, sometimes, you know, a hike is like, oh, we're going to go walk in the woods behind the house. You know, this is not that.
This is not so, that.
Yeah, it's a whole nother.
From Canada to Yellowstone.
Yeah, right. That's pretty wild. So, tell us about this formation of Scotchman's, of the Friends of Scotchman's Peaks. You were there at the inception. You were there at the very beginning. So, you know, where were the connections made and kind of what was that process like?
Sure. It was January 2005.
Mm-hmm.
And again, we were in the midst of forest planning. And a few people I knew who were really interested in moving this forward, we got together and decided, well, let's see if there are some other folks interested that we know who might be helpful in putting together an organization, advancing a cause, looking at examining the question of how do we take this concept that's part of the forest plan and actually move Congress to enact a law to designate the area as wilderness. So we put out some feelers for our first organizational meeting. We had a couple dozen people attend.
Wow.
Of which many stayed really committed and quite a few are still involved today. And then from there it grew. We decided early on that one of our core principles, we would stay focused on the one issue of wilderness in the one area, Scotchman Peaks, so we could really build the broadest consensus around that as possible.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's extremely important, right? If you're going to get something to move, you got to get everybody on the same page. Yeah.
And there seemed to be then, and still truthfully, a broad community consensus in both North Idaho and Northwestern Montana that the area has high value as wilderness.
Right. Yeah. Well, and tell us about the legal process of the designation, because that actually came to a vote.
And so that's a great question. And we could spend hours talking about that, and I'll try to boil it down a few minutes.
However you want to do it.
Wilderness designation is an act of Congress. In 1964, Congress passed the original Wilderness Act, which immediately established about 9.5 million acres of wilderness across 13 states, mostly in the West, and 54 wilderness areas.
Okay.
But most importantly, it set a process out by which other areas could be added to the wilderness system and envisioned a pretty robust process of doing that.
Okay.
One of the really important things is that it took the discretion from the administration, which can designate a national monument, and it took it into the hands of Congress. Only okay. Congress can designate wilderness areas. Hmm. So by nature, it means that you need to get a bill passed. And Congress rarely agrees on much of anything.
Boy, howdy.
That's not just true today. It's been true since its inception. Yep. And it's, a lot of wise people have said that was the intention. Mm-hmm. Original founders of our Constitution wanted to make it hard to pass laws.
That's right. Yep.
And so since the late 1700s to now, only about 4% of any bill that ever gets introduced to Congress gets signed by the president.
That's right. Yep.
That sets a really high bar for wilderness. And so it assures that the areas that are most deserving are the ones that will get in.
Well, and this is just on a side note, this is the workaround for that are these large omnibus bills mm-hmm. where they'll be thousands of little things added on to those larger bills because they can't get them through otherwise. Yeah.
Yeah. So Congress works through a system of internal rules and regulations that are baffling to even those of us who follow it pretty closely.
Yeah.
And they're not absolutely. All in your civics textbook.
No, they're not.
But at the end of it all, what it means is that very few bills pass the Senate.
Yep.
In the Senate, you need unanimous consent. All 100 senators have to agree to at least not opposing something to pass, or you need a supermajority that's controlled by mm-hmm. The party that's in charge, mm-hmm. yep. but 60 votes. And mm-hmm. you need 60 votes over several multiple stages over a week or two. And so it's really hard to get a bill passed.
Wow.
So typically you see a very small number of bills that are very large, not just on wilderness or resource issues, but on anything.
Yeah.
And those large bills then have a lot of other things tucked in, which mm-hmm. Can be the sausage making part we hear of with such distaste.
Yep.
But it is the internal rules that lead the Senate to do that. So
I hear you.
It's an interesting process, and the more you learn, the you wish you knew less.
Right.
Ultimately, for wilderness, the unwritten rule is that most senators will defer to the senators in the state in which the wilderness area would lie. Mm-hmm. And in the House, most of the congressmen will defer to the wishes of the congressional districts in which they lie. And so here we have a proposal that crosses into two states. Mm-hmm. And so we have two state delegations, and the politics mm-hmm. in each state are a little bit different. So the task immediately becomes daunting and takes time.
Yep.
And so what's not written into the wilderness bill or necessarily into the rules in the Senate or the House, but is very real, those congressmen and senators will tend to defer to local interests. So they gauge those in a number of ways.
Okay.
It's not necessary to have a vote, but advisory votes can reveal something. Mm-hmm. It's not necessary to have approval by anyone from within the state or county or local municipalities, but those approvals do matter to the political mm-hmm. process.
Okay.
And so ultimately you have the collective voice of the communities heavily influencing the action of our congressmen. And really that's ideal. So our task since 2005 has been to build that collective voice, reaching out to the broadest number of individuals possible with the mm-hmm. most diverse backgrounds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
we've done a lot of that work since 2005.
Great. Now, now, with that, you've got some support from a wide range of different fields and people with different expertise and different groups. Well, what are some of the groups that you were kind of surprised came on board?
Sure. And, you know, I will say that there are groups we were surprised eventually coming on board, but we knew that at some stage, at some point in time, we would need to engage them. Mm-hmm. And so just stepping back for a moment, the reason there's a wide range is that congressmen and senators aren't necessarily going to be influenced by just one section of the public.
Correct.
And so with all dear love to my conservation friends, if the conservation community alone is suggesting something, that may not be enough for the congressman.
Yep.
It would be the same with any other issue. If the healthcare industry alone was suggesting something, it might not be enough to move a healthcare bill.
Right.
So you need to look at the community at large. And we know that for our congressmen, when they look at natural resource issues, they're very interested in what The timber industry thinks, and what the mining industry thinks, and what off-highway vehicle users think. Who are the other so-called stakeholders who have something to say about natural resources writ large? And that's really the same question that the forest plan addresses. And so some of the work we did during the early forest planning process, where we're in small geographic area committees centered around ranger districts where there's a variety of stakeholders come to bear. We developed some relationships with people from each of those various stakeholder groups. And I've had conversations around what's of interest to them, what's of interest to us. Not so much compromising at that point, but more exploring each other's common interests.
Right.
So
that's good.
Wilderness advances through this political process, but a lot of other land decisions advance through an administrative process.
Correct. Yeah.
The forest plan comes out. It directs the agency to conduct analysis on timber stands, to do a timber sale, and the wood product industry purchases timber, for instance. It's an administrative process. So since about the mid-2000s, about the same time we started this process, throughout the natural resource arena, if you will, collaborative groups have stemmed up.
Okay.
I sit on one locally, the Panhandle Forest Collaborative.
Okay.
One of my friends, colleagues, sits in Libby and the Kootenai Forest stakeholders.
Okay. Cool.
So we sit on two collaboratives directly. We discuss a wide array of issues, look at projects that are related to forest harvest or regeneration, forest health. We look at some recreation. We're going to be doing more focus on that. And we see where we agree on things and where we can support each other. What it really does in the end, those collaborative discussions break down myths and stereotypes and fears about your partner having an agenda. And so I can't support you because I'm afraid of what you want.
Yeah.
It gets replaced with, I can't support you because I trust and know that what you want aligns really with my values.
Yeah.
It's about communities having discussions that are common sense.
There you go. It's about the communication, right? So important. So important. Yeah.
And so through that process, we've formed really positive relationships with a number of people in the timber industry, with most of the senior management of Idaho Forest Group, for instance, but they're not the only timber industry. And it's largely because the fear of a timber wilderness conflict really is based more in fear than in reality. For the most part, wilderness areas such as the Scotchman Peaks that are proposed in our region aren't in the productive timber zones. And so there's really no reason for a natural conflict.
I'll tell you, the people at Idaho Forest Group, they know how to find it.
Yep.
I mean, they're using satellites. They're using all types of amazing technology to find the best wood. And they can determine how much stock from a satellite photo, you know. I mean, it's just amazing.
They do some amazing things.
And technology,
At their production facilities, they're really using some amazing technology, too, to get everything out of the wood product.
So it doesn't seem – I think that you know, there's definitely been the like – how is it that a wilderness and the timber industry are joining forces, but understanding the landscape, and then Idaho Forest Group specifically, you know, they know where their product is and what's most profitable for them writ large than anyone else.
Well, I think, yes. And I think one of the things to do here is to reflect that we're all people and we're all multifaceted. I'm not only a representative of the Friends of Scotchman Peaks interested in wilderness. I'm engaged with the Idaho Trails Association, locally with the Kinnickinnick Native Plant Society. Also sit on the Resource Advisory Council of North Idaho RAC. Inovia Foundation's Leadership Committee to help steer their COVID granting. I'm the past president of the American Long Distance Hiking Association. But I'm a part of this community, and there are projects that are good for this community, timber projects. They're good economically.
Yeah.
They're good for restoring habitat.
Yeah.
They're good for forest health. I support those because they're good projects, not they get something in return. And over the decade or so that we've developed close relationships with folks from the wood products industry, there are folks there who are safe now to talk about their personal association with wilderness. Some of them are wilderness users. They take their horses, they go back into the backcountry hiking, or excuse me, horseback riding and hunting in the fall. They value wilderness. They might have been reluctant to express their personal values before because of this model of conflict, where now they're more free to express their personal values. They're multifaceted.
Yep, absolutely. No, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. And I think being able to step back from any major issue, whether it's, you know, what's happening with the wilderness or anything that's happening even in our world today, being able to step back and find, you know, our common ground and what are the things that we agree on and things. And I think everybody wants healthy forests, and they want, especially they want proper conservation. They want things to go well environmentally. I don't know anybody left or right who doesn't want things to be healthy.
If we break down those fears, we all want clean air. We all want clean water.
Absolutely.
We all want some wildlands where we can take our kids.
That's right.
Yep. We also all want some forest products. Mm-hmm. This is great wood paneling here we're sitting in front of, and I live in a wood house. And a lot of us do in North Idaho. That's a style.
It is.
And they feed mills, which are some really well-paying jobs.
Yep.
There's nothing, there's no shame in saying there's an economic component that's beneficial to our community from producing timber. And with a land management question in which we have suppressed fire for so long, we do have stands of timber that are out of their normal range of variability and are well suited to some active management to help restore them.
Cool.
And these are goals. I think if you break down the fears, and having had conversations over the last 15 years with a really wide range of people, I think most people would be in about 90, 95% agreement with all these things. The language may differ sometimes. We have to catch ourselves and be really careful not to be triggered by words or expressions, to sit back and listen and be curious and be empathetic. And if we really are able to do that, and that's not that easy. But if people really vest the time in listening and developing relationships, we'll find there's a lot more in common than, not.
And I think that that's the majority of our audience. Here at the Barn Breakdown, that's the whole purpose of why we're here, is to have these curious conversations and to discover differing viewpoints wherever that wherever those are. So, no, that's excellent, excellent. So where are things at currently, and what do you see happening, you know, with the Friends of Scotchman's Peak Wilderness moving forward?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the Friends is a couple of things. In addition to the advocacy work we've mentioned, we're also good stewards of the area. And especially since about 2010 now, we've been doing a lot of trail maintenance work, clearing trails, lots of downed trees from storms this last year. And so we have a really robust agenda of doing work on the trails to keep them open for hikers and for horseback riders. We've been doing a lot of work with wildlife education, particularly around the mountain goats, so that people know how to behave safely in goat country. So the goats stay wild, the trails stay open, and hikers stay safe. We worked with Idaho Fish and Game, Department of Idaho Fish and Game, for 4 years on their rare forest carnivore study, looking at the presence of fisher, marten, wolverine, and lynx in the area. And so there's a lot of education and outreach and supportive work we can do to help bring information to the land management agency, the Forest Service, the Wildlife Management Agency, the Department of Fish and Game, that help them make good decisions.
That's great.
Things that we can take with volunteers and do citizen science and activity on the ground. All of that's continuing on, continues to accelerate. We engage more people every year in those things. People are interested in doing something positive for the landscape. And we have a pretty full summer of activities planned in that regard. We delayed the start of our trail maintenance season and our mountain goat ambassador season until July.
Okay.
But we're on track to pick those up.
Cool.
And on the legislative front, you know, that crystal ball that tells you when Congress will do something, I wish I had one of those. Solve a lot of problems.
It would.
Or at least ease a lot of minds. It's hard to say.
Sure.
We do know that in an election year, when there's the presidential election, very few things move forward. And right now, with the need that Congress has to move things forward related to the economy, this would be a back burner issue.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So that makes sense. We don't really expect any progress on legislation for the Scotchman's this year. Potentially in the next cycle or the one after that.
Yeah.
But really the groundwork to bring proposals forward to the delegation that makes sense, we're reexamining. We're looking at what that means on the landscape.
Okay.
For the last 15 years on the Kootenai Forest in Montana, we've been part of the Kootenai Forest Collaborative, as I've mentioned, which has an agreement in principle that would designate Wilderness for the Scotchman Peaks, some wilderness in the Yak, some additions to the Cabinet Mountains wilderness.
Okay.
I would also put in place some areas for motorized recreation that would have some sense of permanency.
Okay.
And would establish some guidelines for timber production that would help with the efficiency of the forest harvest there and regeneration.
I think that a lot of people get the misconception that if you designate something as a wilderness, that it won't be managed and it won't be you know, available, or you know, I think they, people it's, don't really quite grab that it's actually for the purpose of access in a lot of ways.
It's a type of management. It's one in which you have hands off. It's saying this is an area we're going to leave for natural processes. It doesn't mean you can't go in for some overwhelming reason, but it does limit the reasons you'd go in. You really primarily want to let natural processes play out. That's an appropriate thing for part of the landscape, not all of it. And so, for example, in Idaho, the proposed Scotchman Peaks is less than 1% of the entire Idaho Panhandle forest. It's appropriate for that 1%. The rest of the area, the rest of the forest can be managed for other things and should be. So in a way, you might look at it as a zoning question. And the process we've gone through on the Kootenai Forest to look at the zone of the Scotchmans as being appropriate for this and other zones being more appropriate for other things is coming to a place where we may be able to advance a legislative package there in the next session of Congress, or it might be the one after that. A lot depends on the election and how politics line up. There are things there that can help inform our efforts in Idaho. Looking at a broader landscape involving more interests is one way to address a larger set of questions. So if the challenge is a small area may not have all of the things needed for political support, a larger area, you might be able to find the things that would come together. It's, it is that concept's in its very early stages. We need to explore more about what that means for the landscape, not just the Scotchmans. What does that mean for our communities? What are the things most important to our communities in North Idaho that would be significant in a lands legislation? That's an open question that a lot of us will explore.
Well, and you do, you obviously are advocating for a legislative action. You do, you mentioned some educational pieces that you work on with and collaborate on. And yet you also provide activities as well. So, so what are some of the activities that you guys do? You guys do a bunch of different things all the time, you know, whether it's bringing kids in or, you know, different things. So what are some of the things that you do?
The go-to activity when we first started was let's take people out on a hike because people want to get to know the area. Once they do, they're going to fall in love with it. And so we have an active year-round hike series, focuses less on mud season, more summer, winter. but we get almost as many people out in snowshoes in the winter as we do on boots in the summer. We do have a specialized series of activities for kids in the wintertime, our Winter Tracks program, which is about youth education. And it's about a wide array of natural resource topics. We have a lot of volunteers who are interested in lending their expertise. The energy for that program really came out of the four-year rare forest carnivore study, which we concluded in 2012 or 13. And here we had trained over four winters, 300 volunteers, who are now somewhat expert at telling apart a wolverine from a fisher, and knew something about marten tracks and how to set up a camera bait station. And we were trying to figure out, well, what do you do with some of this equipment and that expertise? And we thought, winter tracking. And so it's grown from there, and we have several experts.
That's nice.
Retired Idaho Department of Lands regional forester and a retired 30-year career professional with the Forest Service, silviculturist, teach a, teach a tree ID course as part of Winter Tracks.
So fun.
We do avalanche awareness, orienteering, winter birding, winter twig identification, survival stuff, and the camera bait station and the what's in the snow and... We have a trunk full of pelts and skulls and fake poop. The kids love fake poop. Who doesn't?
Come on. Yeah, absolutely.
So we try to introduce school-age kids to the wonders of outdoors the expertise of professional volunteers we have.
No, that's excellent. That's excellent. And on the educational side, you guys do a podcast. Is that correct?
We thank you. With the pandemic, we decided we needed to do something to really channel the energy of staff into something positive. And we were staring in March down the throat of 3 months of no small activities, at least 3 months. And so we decided we'd put together a podcast series. We launched it at the end of March. I think we're on to episode 9 now, plus a couple bonus ones. We're doing it about every week. And it's featuring a wide array of topics, but mostly related to inspirational wilderness stories or wildlife stories or connecting families in the outdoors or community voices. And we've had a lot of varied voices on it. It's been a lot of fun to put together.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's great. That's great. When you look at the communities overall sentiment from your perspective towards the Friends of Scotchman's Peaks Wilderness and what you guys are doing there? What's the feedback that you get from the community?
Generally, feedback's very positive with especially the stewardship work, the youth education work we're doing. I've heard no complaints to that. As far as the proposal that went down in an advisory vote a couple of years ago, there was a lot of misinformation surrounding that. And I'm not sure that the vote was an accurate reflection of public sentiment as much as it was people voting on an issue that they trusted someone else's opinion on. So I think that the overall sentiment is that people do want to preserve wild places in our county. And I think also the overall sentiment would be that the Scotchman Peaks is a very special place and perhaps uniquely deserving of some form of protection.
Yeah. Well, and it's not like you drew it out of a hat. No, there was a reason for it.
It's been there a long time. The place has been there for millions of years, and it's been sculpted by the hand of God and nature into the wilderness area it is today, as society is back in the 1970s when the Forest Service went through their review of roadless areas and evaluated wilderness. They recommended a wilderness classification for it in the 70s. A wilderness recommendation was made by the forest plan in the 80s. Both of those processes received overwhelmingly large support from the public. In fact, the roadless review in the 1970s, the Scotchman Peaks roadless area received over 3,000 comments, more than any roadless suggested area in the country, and 90% of those were in favor of the wilderness recommendations. So very broad and heavy support from the 70s, same levels through the 80s in the forest plan, similar levels during the forest planning process. And so we move forward to an advisory vote that had perhaps not examined the question on the level that those other three had.
Sure.
And it's a political question at this point, and that's fair enough. And so I think there's room for more conversations going forward, and especially conversations about how does it fit into the mix. I think one of the things that can break down fears is to see that the question of wilderness for the Scotchman Peaks really is tied to the question of how do we best utilize our land in North Idaho, northwestern Montana. Our organization has always believed and still does that on the 4.5 million acres of both forests, there is plenty of room for all of the various multiple uses, including responsible off-highway vehicle use, timber production, as well as regeneration harvest, mining, grazing, and wilderness. Wilderness is one of the multiple uses outlined in the Multiple Use Sustained Yield Act. The Scotchman Peaks for us is the most obvious place where wilderness should be. And through these other collaborative processes, we can help sit with others and have conversations about what are the other best uses. And I think that collaborative process going forward can really be a great forum for discussing a lot of these priorities.
That's great. That's great. Yeah, I think learning how to communicate and use the language and being able to, you know, cross over into communities that may not have an awareness. There's, of course, there's a lot of people up here super passionate about wilderness and about wildlife and about the trails and, you know, whether it's with Kinnexu Land Trust or the Friends of Scotchman's Peaks that some people don't understand what they actually do. And so learning how to cross over that and educate, I think, is just so, so important. Do you find that, you know, doing your work at the Friends of Scotchman's Peaks, what do you find to be the most gratifying part of your job as an executive director there?
I can think of the things that aren't the most gratifying.
I know, that's the easy part.
I think the, I'll tell you what, one of the most gratifying things has been to look at our staff during this time of a pandemic crisis and be able to work on this idea, this podcast that gives everybody something really positive to do and watch our staff members just rise to the occasion and feel really good about something that they've done. And the engagement we've had with community partners on it, and they want to be part of this really positive thing.
That's great.
And so I think one of the best things about the job of being the ED is finding things that can help enable people to be their best.
Yeah.
And then offering them support.
That's good. Awesome. Awesome. So do you have any big trails, hikes coming up?
Oh, that's a great question. So we also combine with paddling, and every other year we've
Let's stop. Let's just stop on the paddling, because you mentioned earlier that you paddled the Yukon.
Yep.
Now, did you did the whole thing?
Yeah, we did. In fact, we did a step that's farther so crazy. Than that. The original
city kid here, grew up in the city, yeah. Paddling the Yukon. That's out of my grid.
So, from the time I was about 7, 8 years old, my dad and I would go backpacking or paddling. We'd sit around a campfire. He told me stories of his dad, my granddad, who I never knew. He passed away before I was born. But my grandfather, in the 19-teens, after he was discharged from the Army in World War One, he became part of the Biological Services, today the Fish and Wildlife Service, and was shipped off to the Panhandle of Alaska to do salmon census. So a little tiny motorboat up and down the Panhandle for 4 summers. On the 4th summer, he was assigned to a string of pack mules with 3 other guys, and they surveyed line of sight the Alaska Range, the northern boundary of what would be established as McKinley National Park.
Wow.
At the end of it, they took a steamer down the Tanana River, back up the Yukon River to Whitehorse, and then up the lakes, over the Chilkoot Pass, and down into Skagway and home. This was only 20 years after the gold rush. There were still people from the Klondike Gold Rush working in the mining fields and populating the steamers. And the wanderlust of Jack London imbued my grandfather in stories he told my dad.
Wow.
And so we decided that at some point we'd have to do that same journey or some similar journey.
Retrace
the gold step, the steps of the gold rush. So in the year 2000, my wife and I and my dad and a couple of friends decided to go on this grand journey together.
That's so fun.
Essentially retraced the steps of the Klondike Gold Rush. And so for my wife and I, that meant getting on a train in San Francisco, Emeryville, taking it up to Seattle, which is what the Klondikers did. Mm-hmm. And then from Seattle, the ferry up the Inside Passage to Skagway.
Okay.
And then we hiked over the Chilkoot Pass. We did not make 50 trips carrying a ton of goods. She talked me out of that concession to history. We had the tourist train take our boat and stuff around to Lake Bennett. We assembled the boat. We paddled the headwater lakes down to the Klondike Goldfields at Dawson, where my dad had completed the journey he'd always wanted to do. And he got on the train and went home. But I knew going in, I would not be satisfied without seeing the rest of the river. That's only about the first 500 miles. So we had decided early on we'd paddle all the way to the Bering Sea. So we continued on down the Yukon as it arcs across Alaska, and it ends 2,000 miles later, just south of Nome.
I've been there.
It is an incredible adventure. There are people who have done it, but not many. Just simply gathering information in 2000 at the dawn of the internet age was time consuming. Some of the best maps we had for portions of it were USGS maps that were printed in the 1940s. In one case, it was the best map we had was the Sternwheeler map from the paddleboat era from 1898. So a lot of it was know the rivers flowing downstream, you know generally how far apart the towns are, and you're watching for them. It's wild country. We have nothing like it in the lower 48.
Oh, nothing. Absolutely not.
But we do have, from having hiked the 3 long trails I mentioned, and exploring most of the truly wild parts of the lower 48, as it were, we do have here in North Idaho and northwestern Montana what I would say is arguably the wildest part of what's left unroaded in the U.S. We have all of the big species that were here at the time of the first white settlers, and including some mega carnivores. You're not at the top of the food chain in grizzly bear country.
That's right.
And yet there's not the same safety net that you have if you're in grizzly bear country in Yellowstone or Glacier.
That's right.
Yep. So a walk in the woods here can be really exciting.
Well, and a walk in the woods in the upper Alaska is a whole nother ball of wax. Is. Yeah.
So these days, every other year, we're doing a paddle trip versus a hike. And our trips have been now confined mostly to a couple of weeks. Last year, we did 4 weeks in the Adirondacks.
Oh, fun.
We created our own route and hiked partly on trail, partly on road, partly cross country, north to south across the Adirondacks in New York. So this year is scheduled to be a paddling year, and we were yet to decide on a location. And now with the still advice to stay closer to home for recreation, and I don't know if Deb's going to see this. I haven't popped it all on her, but I think we're going to do a 2-week trip on paddling around Lake Pendre and Priest Lake system.
Yeah, that's a lot of fun.
Yeah,
wow.
It's close to home. And we're fortunate here that if we do want to take an extended trip, there's plenty of places to go naturally in the rivers and lakes we have for paddling. We have some great trails that can connect the systems here. We're in the path of the Idaho Centennial Trail, the Pacific Northwest Trail. There are some really incredible destinations that My friends in other places wish they had closer to where they live for their summer trips.
I bet. No, that's wonderful. So when you look at what's the future holding? I know we talked a little bit about kind of where things are at now. When you look forward in the next few years, obviously legislation's throw your hands in the air. We have no idea. Mm-hmm. But when you look ahead, what are some things that you're looking forward to with the Friends of Scotchman's?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Friends of Scotchman Peaks, again, are this blend of advocacy and stewardship that really mm-hmm. go hand in hand. Mm-hmm. Our best advocates are our stewards, mm-hmm. and our best stewards are the ones who are most passionate about advocating for the area. And there are groups around the country that focus in on one or the other, and since we've been blending them for the last 10 years, I almost see it as impossible to pull them apart.
Right.
If the day comes when we, and it will at some point, have a designated Scotchman Peaks Wilderness Area, the need for that stewardship doesn't go away.
Right.
The need to maintain trail access, the need to provide information about how to hike safely so that goats stay wild and trails mm-hmm. stay open and people stay safe is still there. The need to bring the next generation up with an appreciation for what the outdoors is still mm-hmm. there. Cool. We've had a lot of conversations with key stakeholders in the organization, current former board members, staff, volunteers. Everyone wants to see an organization going forward that's continued and committed to the idea that we can preserve wildlands best by making sure that they're relevant for people, that there's an experience there for them to be had.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and I think saying that there's an experience mm-hmm. there, and I think that's one of the things that I think about when I read stories about someone getting lost up there, and mm-hmm. search and rescues got drones out, and they're doing all this stuff to try and do their part. It's because it is an experience, and being able to access some of these locations, some of the things that normally we wouldn't necessarily have access to, mm-hmm. to have those experiences. Is there a specific spot up there that you think is like kind of your favorite view?
Oh, boy, that's hard. There are some fabulous, fabulous views. And the one from Scotchman Peak is undeniably great. But but Goat Mountain, which is a steeper trail, not as tall, but steeper, has a really incredible view because you're looking right at the west head wall of Scotchman Peak, but you're also a little closer to the lake and you're a little closer to the Lightning Creek drainage. And so for folks from Idaho, that's got to rank right up there. But Star Peak still has the remnants of a fire lookout tower on it because that lookout could look up and down the Clark River Valley as well as the Bull River Valley, and you get a stunning view of both the Scotchman Peaks as well as the main Cabinet Mountains.
That's gorgeous. Yeah. So fun. Do you have any other thoughts for us today?
Thank you for having me on, and always happy to come back and chat about hiking and paddling and other adventures.
Yeah, one of our goals here is to provide conversations so that we can get to know each other and then also be able to get educated and learn just a little bit more about the things happening around us. So we appreciate you coming on. Thank you.
Thank you, Chris.
All right. Well, have a good one. Thanks for watching.
Thank you for watching today's episode. Please like, follow, share, and subscribe on all of our social media platforms at Bonner Breakdown. And you can also support this show to provide more of these types of conversations at patreon.com/BonnerBreakdown.